Hello, good evening. I'm Dr. Randall Brewer, and welcome to Health Matters here on listener-supported Red River Radio. According to the Centers for Disease Control, the flu season of 2017-18 is on track to be as worse, if not more severe, than the most recent flu epidemic of 2014-2015. Recently, the acting director of the Centers for Disease Control, or commonly known as the CDC, Dr. Ann Schuchat, provided a press release regarding what the current status of the flu is. Let's listen to what Dr. Schuchat had to say.
Facing is influenza. Flu is incredibly complex and difficult to predict, and this season is a somber reminder of why flu is one of the world's greatest public health challenges, and why we at CDC focus so intensely on efforts to fight flu. In the past week, we have seen increased influenza-like illness activity, more hospitalizations, and tragically, more flu-associated deaths in children and adults. And as of this week, overall hospitalizations are now the highest we've seen, even higher than the 2014-15, our previous high season. We also continue to hear reports of crowded hospitals and spot shortages of antiviral medications and rapid influenza tests. Unfortunately, our latest tracking data indicate that flu activity is still high and widespread across most of the nation and increasing overall. Influenza A, H3N2 viruses continue to dominate this season. However, we are seeing other flu viruses, including H1N1 and influenza B, causing illness as well, and in some cases, disproportionately affecting certain age groups. I know many of you are concerned about this flu season and have seen the heartbreaking stories of those who've lost loved ones. This week, we are reporting an additional 16 flu-related pediatric deaths for this season, meaning there are even more families now devastated by flu. That means we've received reports for a total of 53 children who have died of the flu so far this season. I also know there are ongoing concerns about whether the flu vaccine that many people received will be effective, or whether you'll be able to fill a prescription for antiviral medicine. While we don't have all the answers, here's what I can tell you. We continue to recommend the flu vaccine. Even though we know most flu vaccines have low effectiveness against H3N2 viruses, effectiveness against other flu viruses is better, and there is more than one flu virus circulating this season. The vaccine may also reduce the severity of symptoms if you catch the flu in spite of being vaccinated. And it's not too late to get the vaccine. As of January 12th, more than 152 million doses of flu vaccine had been shipped nationwide. I also want to mention vaccine against pneumococcal pneumonia. Some of the serious consequences of influenza are bacterial pneumonias. Viral infections like flu can make people more vulnerable to secondary bacterial infections. And we recommend people 65 years of age and over get vaccinated against a common pneumonia caused by pneumococcus.
That was Dr. Ann Schuchat, the acting director of the Centers for Disease Control, and that was the weekly press release from the Centers for Disease Control regarding the current flu epidemic. This is listener-supported Red River Radio. I'm Dr. Randall Brewer, and you are listening to Health Matters tonight. You can call or ask us questions about the flu or influenza at 1-800-552-8502, or you can tweet a question at RRR Public Radio. We have two very excellent guests here with us tonight. Let's go ahead and meet the guests that we have with us tonight.
This is Dr. Gerardo Negron from Shreveport Infectious Disease.
Welcome back to Health Matters, Dr. Negron.
Thank you.
And Ray Coughlin here from Northwest Louisiana Infectious Disease Consultants. Both of us work hand in hand with Willis Knight in the present time.
Oh, welcome, Dr. Coughlin. Welcome to both you, two very well-respected, experienced infectious disease doctors here, ready to take your questions or listen to your comments about the current flu season. The number is 1-800-552-8502, or you can tweet a question at RRR Public Radio. Let's go ahead and back up a little bit and start with a little bit of what we would consider basic science regarding the flu virus itself. Dr. Negron, what distinguishes the flu virus from any other sort of respiratory illness or any sort of viral infection, or distinguishes it from a bacterial infection as well?
Well, in terms of upper respiratory viruses, there are numerous different genera of them. Everybody's heard of the common cold virus, which is one. Influenza actually comes in at least three types, A, B, and C, and there might be a few more. A and B are basically what afflict humans. All of these things are spread through respiratory droplets, talking, sneezing, coughing. But influenza, unlike some of the common cold viruses, much severer in terms of its manifestations. Viruses are genetically different than bacteria, so we'll stick with the viruses. But almost nobody's going to die of a common cold virus, rhinovirus, coronavirus. There's lots and lots of these things. Flu, however, is in a different category, since typically in a regular flu season, you can have 30 or 40,000 people in the country die every year. Every single year.
So, what, Dr. Coughlin, what makes the flu virus so much more severe and more potentially deadly than the common cold virus?
Oh, that's a great question. I think that its invasiveness, more so, its attack on the immune system and how the immune system responds is quite different. And the many, many strains, we say influenza virus, the influenza virus, just A itself has 39 permutations and combinations. So we're not talking about one red car or something like that. And so they are a little more invasive, and each strain could be attack your immune system a little differently. And that's when Dr. Shukat said that the complexity, that's just the scientific complexity of it.
From the standpoint of public health, I understand that, there's a flu season. That's why we talk about flu this time of year, and this particular flu season has been particularly severe. Dr. Negron, why do we have a flu season as opposed to other illnesses which may occur at any time during the year?
Well, it really has to do with how it spreads. So when it is summer in our hemisphere, the southern hemisphere, South America, they're having their flu season. And when they get summer, we get winter. People are cooped up. Central air spreading pathogens that people are either coughing or sneezing up. So once you get enclosed, hence during the colder season, that's when you see the outbreaks.
So it basically circles the globe according to the seasons of the year.
Pretty much. That's a good way to put it.
And why is it that, Dr. Coughlin, that we have to get vaccinated every year? I was just vaccinated once for most of the things I've been vaccinated for, or at least one series, right? But I have to get the flu vaccine every year. At least I should. Or you should. We should. We all should.
Everybody over the age of 6 months in this, it's recommended by the CDC, everybody over the age of 6 months in this country. It varies from country to country, and so I'll refer to the Australia-New Zealand outbreak this year where there were over 1.5 million people with contracted the flu. Their vaccine recommendations usually for those 65 and over, so it varies, and so the statistics vary a little there too. Sorry, the question originally was?
So the question was regarding the vaccination process. We talk about getting a flu vaccine every year. Typically, vaccinations are given in a series, right? We get vaccinated once for measles, once for mumps, once for rubella, for hepatitis, and so forth, HPV. Why is it that we have to get vaccinated for the flu on a yearly basis? Why is it so important to update that vaccine every year? And how does that process
unlike
work?
Unlike the other viruses, we see genetic mutations every year with influenza. And in both A and B strains, those variations lead to a new vaccine. I mean, and then the vaccine is, if you look at, as Dr. Nagar mentioned, the Southern Hemisphere, you see the evolution. The World Health Organization then tries to determine what type of vaccine is going to be best for us, and CDC then follows that guide in developing the vaccine for the United States, for North America, basically. But even so, it mutates. It can mutate as we go, and therefore lose some of its usefulness, the vaccine's usefulness, rather than. Again, it's the mutations in it that lead to the need for having the vaccine every year.
Yeah, this is quite remarkable, Dr. Negron. So this is a virus that literally we have to chase around the world every year in terms of its genetics.
Yes, that's true. And as previously mentioned, because if you stick with the influenza A, which is what we refer to when we give numbers to the H and the N letters, it is drifting genetically every single year. And every few years to a few decades, we have a really big drift. That's when we have what's called a worldwide epidemic or a pandemic. That's the famous one being right at the end of the First World War into 1919, the Spanish flu. And we've had a few since then, but that's the really famous one. But it's because it's constantly changing, we are constantly trying to keep up.
Dr. Coughlin, there's reports on the internet. We just had a caller offer this question that there's some concern that after you take the flu shot, that it compromises your immunity to the flu in subsequent years, such that perhaps natural immunity doesn't develop. Is there any evidence that taking the flu shot makes you more prone to getting the flu in subsequent years and sort of creates a dependency state on re-immunizing yourself against the flu every year? Is this a self-propelling situation, or is there any evidence to support that contention?
No, there's in fact the opposite is quite true. The fact that you augment your immune system, or you bolster, or you upgrade your immune system with the vaccine, and subsequent years, it's thought that there will be some, if you will, after effect from previous years' boosting of your immune system rather than taking it away. And so that's why, again, if you look at a pediatric, if a pediatric patient has never been immunized, they get the vaccine twice. There's two doses of vaccine the first time. And that's to get the boost. But it does not take away any part of your ability to fight influenza or any other virus, to our knowledge.
Dr. Negron, I have another question for you, but before I get to the question for you, I'm going to go ahead and give the number out again. And that number for Health Matters tonight, it's 1-800-552-8502. And I know many of you are either dealing with trying to not get the flu because it's such a big issue this year, or perhaps you've had the flu and you need advice or have comments about what your experience has been. So give us a call, 1-800-552-8502. This is Health Matters on listener-supported Red River Radio tonight. Dr. Negron, going back to the flu vaccine itself, is there any evidence that the flu vaccine can cause serious damage or side effects? We hear occasionally sort of campaigns against vaccines in general, such that, you know, there's conspiracy theories that vaccinations cause certain chronic diseases, from anything from autism to seizure disorders to who knows what. Is there any evidence that the flu vaccine can cause harm?
A simple answer first, and let me elaborate for a moment. The answer is no. And I repeat, the answer is no. And
that's about as simple as that as it can get.
About 17 to 18 years ago, many of the anti-vaccine proponents had latched on to a report in the British journal, The Lancet, of numerous side effects, including autism related to the influenza vaccination. And that was kind of kicked around for a long time, and many subsequent studies could not reproduce their findings. And we came to find out about, somewhere between 3 and 5 years ago, that the lead author of that particular widely reported study, often cited, had fudged the data. So, the publication, the Lancet Journal, subsequently withdrew the study. So in hindsight, a lot of what people were claiming was based upon fictitious data. It was altered. Now, there are side effects. Your arm will hurt. You may feel bad for a day or two. Nobody ever contracted influenza from the shot because the virus is dead. Unlike the inhaled via intranasal vaccine, which is currently not recommended, nobody ever got the flu from taking the flu shot. Now, that doesn't mean you can't get cold viruses, which might be mistaken, which you probably will if it's a bad cold and flu season. But it is generally safe.
That's an excellent point that you bring up. So the flu vaccine is not going to protect you against the common cold.
No.
And so the other issue is not only chronic diseases such as autism, but some post-infectious diseases have also been sort of linked to, or it's been mentioned that things such as Guillain-Barré syndrome, post-infectious encephalomyelitis, things along those lines, can be caused from vaccinations, even the flu vaccine. Obviously, post-infectious syndromes do occur. There's molecular mimicry that occurs, so the immune system sort of thinks that a protein in the brain or somewhere else in the nervous system is the virus or is a bacterium, and there's this post-infectious phenomenon that occurs. Is there any evidence that vaccines have anything to do with post-infectious syndromes such as those?
Now, if you go back to the 76 swine flu, that's where you started to see that link. And you will find, if you read the package insert from the manufacturer, you'll see a few cautions about weird things that can come up. But we're talking about cases, one per several million. So we make a medical decision that the benefit, not dying from influenza, which is obviously the most serious complication, the benefit far outweighs a very infrequent risk.
So that's very important information, Dr. Coughlin, to understand, is that the risk of something that's extremely small, one in a million or less, is not, you know, doesn't justify withholding the vaccine from yourself or, you know, recommending it to your children or parents, friends, because the risk of actually dying from the flu is higher than the risk of having a post-vaccination complication from the flu itself.
Thank you. The Guillain-Barré occurrence post the 1976 swine flu vaccination is, as Dr. Negron said, it's never been identified again. We do, as he mentioned also in the Guillain-Barré, it's advised that people who have had Guillain-Barré for whatever reason certainly never or not receive live attenuated virus, which we're not using. And then there's a relative contraindication, not an absolute contraindication, suggested for the inactivated vaccine. But again, you alluded to a post-infectious encephalomyelitis or post-infectious whatever. That's usually post-infection, of which the vaccine we're trying to prevent. And again, if we don't prevent it absolutely, we can alter the disease process.
Let's go ahead and take our first caller of the evening. Welcome to Health Matters tonight, Michael from Shreveport.
Good evening. Thank you so much for taking my call and for this fine show. The question that I had deals with the comparisons between, or the differences between, flu symptoms and cold symptoms. I typically don't go to the doctor when I have a cold. I'll take over-the-counter medication. And to my knowledge, with the exception of this year, I've never had the flu. And I noticed some pretty significant differences in terms of symptoms. But I thought that maybe you all could help the listeners to help them in terms of them distinguishing whether or not they need to go to the doctor thinking they may have a cold when, in fact, they have the flu, and maybe there's some symptoms, the onset or the timing or the severity of the onset may be different for them flu than it is the cold. And I'll hang up and just listen to what you say.
Michael, that's such a great question because there's a lot of overlap. Dr. Negron, from your standpoint, how would you distinguish flu symptoms versus upper respiratory symptoms from non-influenza viruses?
Now, some of the symptoms, you feel bad, runny nose, coughing, will, as you have mentioned, overlap. However, some of the more unique symptoms with influenza versus just colds, many a patient will describe the severe muscle aches and joint aches, like they got hit by a car, severe aching everywhere. You can get a fever from any cold virus, but the fever related to influenza typically is impressive. And those are some of the big distinctions, the muscle aches, the joint aches, and you have a real bona fide fever. And then, unlike a cold, which might take several days to go away, if you don't take influenza virus medications to potentially shorten the duration of your symptoms by several days, you may very well be sick for a good 1 to 2 weeks. And typically people who have actually had doctor-diagnosed influenza, they will tell you they can tell the difference once you've experienced, and it's not anything I would recommend experiencing.
Yeah, and the CDC has a great website, as it turns out, and a lot of this very basic information is available directly on their website. Dr. Coughlin, what would you add to that distinction?
I would support your statement that anybody and everybody could go to the CDC website at cdc.gov/influenza, and you'll get all the information you need. With regard, I noticed that Dr. Schaffner from Vanderbilt's been quoted a fair amount this year, an infectious disease physician there who basically said that the cold is above the neck, and once it goes beyond the neck, then you can suspect influenza. However, I'm not quite sure I agree with that perfectly, but because there are probably most people who get influenza have a very mild disease. So they may think they have a cold, but they actually have influenza. But as Dr. Negron pointed out, if you give a temperature that's, you know, 100.45 or more, you know, not 99 degrees, but as I say to most of the patients, it's not the number that's important, it's the way you feel. But if you've got severe aching and shaking, then you need to call your doctor. And specifically, we may be talking about young people who are generally well. However, it's even more important to try to delineate, should I go to the doctor, I'm on dialysis, renal dialysis, or I have chronic lung disease, or I have diabetes, or I'm pregnant. Well, then I think that you should not be afraid to overreact in an environment where everybody's talking about the flu as we are, because it's epidemic. And so at this time of year, if you start getting chills and you start having a sore throat and a cough and a headache, I think I think that the bar is a little lower than usual, and that's when I would be calling my doctor. Now, most doctors are inundated. Most emergency rooms and hospitals are gradually becoming inundated with influenza patients, I mean, whether they're outpatients or inpatients. I mean, Willis Knighton, we've seen a hundred positive tests in the last week, more than the week before. So, and we have at least close to 15% of the beds occupied by people with influenza or influenza complications. So it's significant, and as Dr. Negron also pointed out, for those of us who have ever had influenza, you don't want it ever, and certainly never after you've had it the first time. And so, again, we both suggest that people get vaccinated regardless of what they feel and what they've heard. Just do it.
Well, there's also the herd immunity concept, correct? We can spread the flu before we even know it. And, you know, the caller brings up a really good point. You know, when do you decide whether or not to go to the doctor? Because certainly we hear stories of even doctor's offices saying, if you have the flu, don't come here. We have people who, you know, we don't want to catch the flu, whether they're well visits or they're people getting their heart checked, getting follow-up for their chronic diabetes or chronic respiratory disease, because we know the herd immunity rate is relatively low. And so even doctor's offices, you know, feel that patients could be at risk, and so you see signs on the front of the door if you have a fever, cohere, or, you know, you see lots of masks and waiting rooms and things along those lines. So I think if you are going to go to the doctor, it's probably a good idea to get a mask ahead of time. Call the doctor, make sure they are accepting patients who have flu symptoms. Dr. Negron, how would you recommend patients approach that?
Well, on that particular topic, if you have a cold, which is by far the worst one you've ever had in your life, it may very well be influenza. And not that uncommonly, there are some severe complications. Whether it's actual flu pneumonia, there are cases of myositis, lysing all your muscles, going into kidney failure. There are some really bad things. So if you believe it's far worse than anything you've had, you need to go to the doctor. Now, they may insist that you put on these little surgical masks that are sufficient, or they may kind of segregate their sick versus their well side. You see that in the pediatric offices frequently. But you need to go, because the treatment, if given within a certain amount of time, if you diagnose it typically within about 2 days when your symptoms start, the treatment is safe, and it might improve your symptoms, and it could actually save your life.
That's a great point. So the worst cold ever, and let's go ahead look at this table that the CDC has published regarding, you know, flu versus cold symptoms, onset. The flu is fast. A cold symptoms are relatively gradual. Fever is going to last longer with the flu, 3 to 4 days. Fever is rare with a cold. Aches are very common with the flu, very severe and very slight with a cold or other respiratory viruses. Chills are common with the flu, uncommon with a cold. Fatigue, weakness, what we call malaise in medicine, illness behavior, just not wanting to move, is very common with the flu, not so much with a cold virus. Sneezing, not as common with the flu as it is actually with the cold virus. Stuffy nose, sore throat, those are more, like Dr. Coughlin referenced, more common with the cold viruses as opposed to the flu. Chest discomfort is common with the flu. It can be severe. And mild to moderate with maybe a hacking cough with upper respiratory virus. Headache is fairly common with the flu and actually rare with the cold virus. Obviously, unless there's a superimposed sinusitis, which is common to cause a headache. The other disease that is fairly common this type of year, but I do believe it occurs year-round, that can present similar to the flu that's actually not a viral infection but a bacterial infection, is streptococcus, in children or in adults. Dr. Coughlin, how would you distinguish symptoms of streptococcus from the flu if a patient was trying to figure out whether or not to go to the doctor? Are they distinguishable?
Streptococcal pneumoniae is alluded to by Dr. Shukat too, for certainly people with diseases, ongoing chronic diseases, that we link the influenza vaccine with the streptococcal pneumonia vaccine, or the pneumonia shot, as it's colloquially known as, that every patient that goes into the hospital is advised to receive both these. The conjugate vaccine, the conjugate pneumococcal vaccine, has been used in children for over 20 years. Let me see now. I think 20 years now. And it introduced into adults probably 10 years ago or so. But the other pneumococcal vaccine has been around close to 20 years for adults as well. Anyway, the point being that we should immunize people. We have a vaccine for pneumonia. Now, to get back to your question, the difference or the suggestion here is that we get a virus, it alters our immune system, it alters how our lungs work, how the little hairs get rid of virus and mucus and then subsequent to the virus, then we're set up for a bacterial infection, or we can be. And streptococcal pneumonia is number one. Probably these days Staph aureus is number two, but still streptococcal pneumonia. And it's an extremely aggressive bacteria. Certainly when you've had your immune system altered already, and then that can easily, and people are going to hear the word sepsis in on the television, the radio, and if you suspect if you feel terrible, you call the doctor. I mean, that's the basis. It's usually a dry cough. You have a dry cough with influenza. With streptococcal pneumonia, usually you do not. It's productive, and actually it can produce a sputum that looks rusty. And it's rusty because there's blood in it. And if you see anything like that, you present with suddenly an increase in sputum production, then absolutely call the doctor or go to the emergency room or urgent care center of some sort.
Dr. Negron, we have another question about strep. Let's remind our listeners of the phone number. It's 1-800-552-8502, or you can tweet at RRR Public Radio. This is Health Matters. Tonight we are discussing the current influenza season, and epidemic, if you will. We're talking about how to distinguish the flu from other common illnesses this time of year. And we were talking about strep, and Dr. Coughlin mentioned how important it is to recognize the symptoms of pneumonia caused from the Streptococcus pneumonia bacterium. What about pharyngitis? Streptococcus pharyngitis is fairly common, especially in younger individuals, and the flu can present with a sore throat as well. Dr. Negron, how would you distinguish between those two entities for the listeners perhaps early on with symptoms?
Now, just to make a distinction, then kind of get into symptoms. When we talk about streptococcal pharyngitis, as in back of the throat, tonsils, that area, when we treat that, we're treating for one very specific bacteria, something called Strep pyogenes or Strep group A, and we are treating to prevent bad things from happening that it can elicit because of an immune response, not necessarily because it gives you a sore throat or fever or makes your tonsils look white and ugly when the doctor looks in the back of your throat. Having said that, pharyngitis with Streptococcus group A, the back of your throat will be coated. It will hurt to swallow. You will have a fever. You will have tender lymph glands under your chin and the rest of your jawbone. And eventually, even if you actually gave no antibacterial medicines, it goes away. But we don't give antibacterial medicines to make it go away. We give it for a completely separate reason, which is way too complicated to get into. But we're not going to have necessarily the coughing. We're not necessarily going to have the severe muscle pains that we had mentioned previously. And some of the other more generalized symptoms where we feel terrible, no get up and go, severe achiness everywhere. Those systemic type symptoms will be absent with group A streptococcus pharyngitis.
And let's move along into testing, if you will. A number of patients will go and have a test for either the flu or maybe a swab in the back of the throat or a blood test. Dr. Coughlin, how do we make the diagnosis of flu or, upper respiratory diseases after we see the doctor? What does the doctor do to actually make the diagnosis to determine what the next best treatment will be?
Well, the first of all, a physician has to suspect the disease and then order the test. The tests can be done. There's office tests, which are antigen tests, which are 50 to 70% sensitive, meaning you can pick up the disease in a certain population, and then is that the actual disease that you're seeing? Is specificity, that makes some sense. And the antigen tests are over 90% useful or specific, whereas
which means if it's negative, it's 90% unlikely that you have the disease. That's what specificity is, correct?
Correct. But the tests done in most laboratories or laboratories these days are more accurate, more specific, and much more sensitive. Those are molecular testing, nucleic amplification tests, and so we're much better at making the diagnosis of influenza than we've ever been. But it takes you can, as you mentioned, a nasal swab or a throat swab. A nasal swab usually done nasopharyngeal, which means the back of the nose into the throat. People shudder when you say that, but it's really not that bad. And a swab of your throat for streptococcus, again, I must reemphasize what Dr. Negron said about the fact that the streptococcus for pharyngitis is usually called a group A streptococcus, which is not the streptococcus that you are given the vaccine for. streptococcus that you give in the vaccine is a group, is streptococcus pneumoniae, and which is more of an opportunistic bacterium when it comes to infecting individuals who already have the flu. You usually don't go looking for sore throat. If you make the diagnosis of flu and you have a sore throat, it's unlikely you're going to swab the throat to find out if you got streptococcus there. As Dr. Negron also mentioned, you could find group A streptococcus in the throat of an individual perfectly well. So it's not absolutely diagnostic. You have to have symptoms for the doctor to think you should have the test.
You know, that I mean, this really sort of opens up a Pandora's box when it comes to treatment, because if you could swab just a random sample of the population, Dr. Negron, and get a positive result for streptococcus in patients presenting with a sore throat from another etiology, for example, testing positive for streptococcus are likely to be treated for, as you mentioned, the potential complications that might arise from an untreated infection. So that becomes somewhat of a quandary.
Well, to add this to the discussion of that topic, antibiotic overuse is a national problem. It's a worldwide problem, but it is definitely a problem in this country. And typically, because many lay people don't understand that, you are literally filled on the surface and in your interior with oodles and oodles and oodles of different microbes, which are supposed to be there. And in any given percentage of the population, especially if they're younger children, if you went and looked every day for a month of for kindergartners starting school, many of them will have group A strep. If it is just colonizing them, or as some people will say, they're carrying it, that's a common layperson description, there's no reason to look for it. There's no reason to try to eradicate it, because it will come back. They will get it from their peers again. So it's to be left alone. Now, if people come in with certain symptoms and it's July and they have a runny nose and they're sneezing and they're coughing, at that point, there's no influenza around. If their tonsils look fine, they don't have big swollen lymph nodes, they most likely have one of the viruses, which is commonplace for that time of year. Which also brings up the distinction, because influenza is seasonal. It's when we're in close quarters during the colder months. Usually by the end of April, flu season is typically finished in the northern hemisphere. So if we have symptoms that we think are flu, well past when the last case has been identified by your local health department or health unit, look for something else. July and August, we have no flu. Unless you've traveled to the southern hemisphere to go to Brazil or Australia, we're not going to have it. So in that instance, you have a cold.
Very good information. This is Health Matters on listener-supported Red River Radio. I'm Dr. Randall Brewer, and we are discussing this year's flu epidemic. You can call for questions or comments with our guests here. We have Dr. Gerardo Negron with Shreveport Infectious Disease, as well as Dr. Raymond Coughlin with an infectious disease specialist as well. The number for your questions or comments is 1-800-552-8502, or you can tweet at RRR Public Radio. Dr. Coughlin, from the standpoint of antiviral therapy, we have a question that was sent in. It's recognized that in some places in the country, the antiviral medication Tamiflu is actually in short supply. Do we know if our supply here locally is sufficient at the present time, or what's the status of that? Or have either of you guys heard?
As far as I'm aware, that we have no shortage. Jerry?
I think there have been spot shortages across the country, but it's not a severe problem yet. However, there's unfortunately a lot of flu season that's yet to come.
Which is a great lead-in to the next question. Is it starting to slow down in Louisiana? And that also begs the question, those of our listener community who have not received the flu vaccine yet, should they go ahead and become immunized now in the peak or well into flu season?
Part one, in the lower 48 states of the U.S., I think one state it may have peaked. The rest of the country, the lower 48, it's still raging, which means since we can easily have another 2 to 3 months of influenza season, and it's not going away yet, if you have not received your influenza vaccination, the actual shot, the flu shot, yes, you should get it. Yes, it's still around, and yes, there's plenty of providers who will have it to provide to you. Because, again, not to overstate matters, but it might save your life.
Interestingly, in the Southern Hemisphere, we saw a marked increase in influenza B. Now, when we talk about seasonal influenza, we're usually talking about influenza A. And that's the, as Dr. Negron mentioned, the H and the N. This is usually the H3N2, which can be quite aggressive and has shown itself that way this year. We peaked last year with our seasonal influenza at about this time. We haven't peaked yet. And I must say that we've also seen more B, as I say, in up to, let's see, we had 1,800 and some tests done last week, of which there's about 100 more B positive than A positive at Willis-Knighton. So we're seeing, but the point is the vaccine covers both A and B. And so, again, there's two subtypes or strains of A in the vaccine, and one or two, depending on whether you have tri- or three-valent or four-valent vaccine at your disposal. So I would still, again, it's not too late. In fact, considering this is going to be an anticipated severe season, that, as Dr. Negron said, we should be out there still promoting vaccination.
And that's what you're doing right now, so thank you so much. Dr. Negron, how effective is the flu vaccine this year?
I must lay a caveat first. And that caveat is, in any given year, the flu vaccine varies from when you're young to you're older in terms of preventing the flu. If you're young, it does a good job. As you get older, 60, 70, 80, occasionally 100-year-old, it's not so good at preventing. But it prevents the severe complications, which the ultimate one being dying from primary influenza pneumonia. So even in years where the match may not be good, and I don't know off the top of my head how the match is, meaning what we put into the vaccines versus what is floating around in a given community, you still get benefit from your current vaccine as well as ones you've had previously, because there's only so many versions to go around. And if this year was not a good match and you've been vaccinated for 25 years, you may still have some cross-protection from your previous vaccinations.
You know, that's an excellent point. We don't hear that brought up much, and I apologize for breaking in, but I just wanted to emphasize that point. This year's strain could circle back around in 2 or 3 years, and you have residual immunity from that. So right. there's a cumulative, potentially a cumulative effect.
Well, if you recall, about 7 or 8 years ago, I think it might have been 09, we had two flu shots that year because that's when H1N1, which is a particularly aggressive version of the A virus, was running around the communities. And we continue to have that particular version crop up from year to year, sometimes in small numbers, other times in larger quantities. And we don't necessarily have H1N1 in every single flu season's virus, but it, as this is an example, it tends to come back, as you have stated.
Very good information. Dr. Coughlin, would you care to add?
As we mentioned to the caller earlier, that it promotes the immune system, and so the more little fighters you have running around in your bloodstream because of vaccination, the better off you are.
Yeah, and Dr. Negron mentioned, you know, differential immunity in terms of, you know, individuals who may be at risk for not mounting a sufficient immune response to completely prevent the illness. Are there adjuvants that are given in special populations in people who need protection and may not have the immune response, such as the elderly or patients who are at risk for having more severe symptoms? Are there ways of getting a stronger vaccination, for example, a booster?
No, we don't usually advocate that at the present time, and we don't suggest that with all the different immunotherapies that we have, that we use that as adjunctive therapy to the vaccine.
Just to add what Dr. Coughlin had said, there are numerous flu name brand, meaning from different companies, flu vaccines which are in the market. There's at least 6 to 8, maybe more. There is one version of the flu vaccine which likes to promote itself as being more effective in the elderly by having a greater number of greater amount of antigenic material, which is the components of the actual virus. Whether that actually works better or not is not entirely clear, but there is at least one company promoting its product that way, meaning more stuff in the vaccine, better response, indicated for age 65 and up, which are typically don't respond as well. But the jury on whether that claim is true is still out.
Okay, so no reason to have one particular flu vaccine over another at the present time, regardless of your health status, whether you're a pregnant woman or elderly person with chronic lung disease, or a normal child or otherwise healthy individual. Same flu vaccine for everyone.
Well, we can argue the point, but as Dr. Negron said, there are no studies that show better outcomes with a higher dose for the elderly population, but certainly a higher dose for younger populations and pregnant populations is not warranted.
Here's a question that comes up. I'm young and healthy, and what if I just get the flu and get through it this year? Won't it protect me for having the flu next year?
Well, that's the as mentioned several times, the influenza viruses are intelligent and they are changing themselves from year to year, which is why we are entitled as humans to get influenza every single year, because the virus, a previous year's version, will probably be different than next year's versions and then the year after that. And we found out from the H1N1 from several years ago, which is a particularly virulent strain, it was the young, healthy people, including children, who were most adversely affected. And based on that, we had changed the recommendations for getting the vaccine. As previously mentioned, the current indications are very simple. If you're a human, you're 6 months of age or older, and you're going to be alive in influenza season, typically November to sometime in April, get vaccinated.
This is Health Matters on listener-supported Red River Radio. I'm Dr. Randall Brewer, and we are discussing the current influenza season. We may have time for one more caller at 1-800-552-8502, or you can tweet at RRR Public Radio. We have infectious disease specialists here tonight discussing our current flu epidemic. It is not too late to receive the flu vaccine, and doctors, I'm just going to go ahead and read from the CDC a list of patients who are at significant risk of having an adverse outcome or risk of developing flu complications. children younger than 5, especially those under the age of 2. As Dr. Coughlin mentioned, adults over the age of 65. Residents of long-term care facilities or nursing homes. Pregnant women and women up to 2 weeks postpartum. Patients with weakened immune systems. Patients who have chronic illnesses such as asthma, heart disease, kidney disease, and diabetes. And patients who have an elevated body mass index of 40 or higher, or obesity. As well as recommendations that have been given regarding controlling the spread of the infection. So once you get the flu, it's important to not give it away to someone else. And so, as we've mentioned, the vaccine is not 100% effective, so it's important to take measures to reduce the spread of the infection. As infectious disease specialists say all the time, wash your hands. Thorough and frequent hand washing is a very effective way to prevent many common infections. Contain your coughs and sneezes. And so once you get that upper respiratory infection, use the mask, especially if you're going to be around these vulnerable populations, if you're going to be around the extreme young or the elderly, or if you're going to be visiting someone in a nursing home or a long-term care facility. And again, if you think you have the flu or you have an infection, it's not a good time to go into a crowded situation. Maybe, you know, skip the concert or, you know, stay home from those large public gatherings when those symptoms first arise. Dr. Garon, please add to
somewhat of a local anecdotal report. Many of the local private hospitals have actually had nosocomial, meaning developing in a patient in the hospital, influenza. And it's not unique to any of the local private hospitals. It's happened in every single one. There's at least one individual who had succumbed to that. And in the majority of the instances, the staff were not diagnosed with influenza, which means it was the visitors. So when the hospital at the main entrances put up signs that if you're sick, don't come in, they really do mean it, because there have been a number of individuals who, from their visitors, friends, family, have come down with flu, even though they may have been hospitalized for weeks at this point before they got the flu.
Excellent points. Dr. Coughlin, would you care to add anything to that concept in terms of public health measures? You're widely traveled, and
our local church members, the bishop and other leaders in our religious community have also advised, although contrary to some people's belief, you shouldn't go to church on Sunday or Wednesday or whenever if you've got the flu. Stay home, please.
And thank you guys very much for listening to us tonight, and thank you so much to our guest tonight, Dr. Gerardo Negron, as well as Dr. Raymond Coughlin, infectious disease specialist. Health Matters is a program for informational purposes only. For all health questions, you should consult a physician or health professional. This show is available for download from redriverradio.org. Health Matters is a production of Red River Radio. The producer is Renee Moran. Production assistance tonight has been provided by Mr. Wally Derleth, Tim Snell, and Sheila Lawrence. Support for this program comes from the Noel Foundation, as well as from the Community Foundation of North Louisiana. Also, please tune in this Sunday at 6 p.m. for the BBC special on the flu epidemic of 1918-1919. Also, join us next Thursday for Health Matters as we discuss cancer screenings. I am Dr. Randall Brewer, and thank you so much for joining us this evening.